Ghosts, shapeshifters, divinities, superhumans. We're accustomed to seeing them in movies, and they're all the rage in books in the 21st century, but they go back a long way, and they have run roughshod over novels, stories, and plays as far back as those things have existed. And they may go back even farther than we know in China, as we'll find out shortly. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Rania Huntington, professor of Asian languages and cultures at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air. This, as soon as you say China, you have a large topic almost no matter what you're pursuing. But if we're going to talk about supernatural literature, how would you like to define that?
Well, I think most of what I'm going to be talking about today, we're talking about the things before the 20th century, although some of these topics did continue on into the 20th century and are still topics of adaptation and popular film and popular media now. My work is mainly on this kind of literature from the 16th through the 19th century, but the kinds of stories that I'm talking about today go back much further. The particular genre, this Tales of the Strange, that I've done the most work on, starts to become really popular around the 4th century AD and then keeps getting written as long as the Chinese written tradition kept going.
And what kind of forms, what kind of genres are we talking about?
Well, when you're talking about the literature of the supernatural in China, there's big distinctions. What I was just talking about, these tales of the strange, these are short tales written in the classical language that purport to be something that somebody saw or that they heard. So they're at least pretending to be based on hearsay. There's some useful comparisons with urban legends. So there's the classical language tales. Then there are, and this may be familiar to some listeners, there are big sprawling novels with casts of gods and demons. And the one that's of those that is the most well-known in translation is The Journey to the West, the story of the Monkey King. And those would be long novels in the vernacular language, often like 100 chapters long, with a close relationship with storytelling and performance literature.
Where do we start seeing novels in China?
If we're talking about long vernacular novels like that, our earliest surviving editions of most of them are from the 16th century, but they go back, again, depending on what you believe about textual antecedents in history, a few centuries before that. But we're talking of that mainly the Ming and the Qing dynasties.
Who would have been the readership for those?
For the novels?
Yes.
Or for the tales?
Well, either.
Either. All right. Because, for the novels, if we're talking about them as written novels, people would need to have had some degree of literacy, which was a minority of the population at that time. But because the novels are in the vernacular language, you'd have to have some literacy, but you wouldn't have to have had a classical education. So people who were merchants and working in a shop and had enough characters to run the accounts might have been able to read them. Certainly, anyone who was aspiring to a career in government service would have been able to read these. But a major point to make about these stories is that they're not, and I'm talking about the stories in the long novels like The Monkey King, these are not just print novels. The exact same stories were told in oral storytelling and showed up on the stage. So if you want to talk about the audience not for the novel between two pages but for the story, that would be really everybody because theater and drama was performed in all sorts of different places, at temple festivals, storytelling was available in a lot of private and public settings. So in terms of being familiar with the names of some of these most popular gods and monsters, that's a really broad cross-section of the population. If we're talking about the short Tales of the Strange, those are written in the classical language. And it's an imperfect comparison, but kind of like the relationship of Latin to the European vernaculars in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, so that you had a language which was the official language of education, which, although it was written more or less with the same body of characters, has a distinct grammar from the spoken vernacular and some distinct word use. So to be able to read these stories, you would need to have had a classical education. However, in terms of reading them, we're talking about a more elite group. But they are often translations and transcriptions from stories that were being told by all different people, all sorts of people from all different walks of life. So they're reflecting ideas that were circulating in a wider circle than the people who would actually pick them up and read them as a book.
Is there a point where there's a commercial element to these, i.e. that they were actually sold to a readership?
Absolutely. Starting in the late Ming Dynasty, we have a boom in commercial publishing. And so particularly the long novels I'm talking about before, the fact that we have our surviving editions from this period is reflecting that boom in commercial publishing. And in terms of those short classical language tales of the weird, yes, some of the collections of those were also popular books that were frequently reprinted. Some of them weren't. Some of them seem to have been much more individual scholars' curiosity books, right? Things that they were preserving for themselves and for a small circle. But yes, these subjects had commercial potential.
When you're mentioning the late Ming Dynasty, would you like to translate that into Roman numerals?
Sorry. Yeah, when one gets used to one's own circle. So the late Ming, we're generally talking about the 16th and the first half of the 17th century.
And what kind of entities? You've described these as kind of, well, you've used that word strange in terms of characterizing the short tales of the strange, for example, and you've mentioned the Monkey King. What kind of strange are we talking about here? What kind of characters are we likely to run into?
All right. First, I'll start with categories that may seem relatively recognizable for coming from an English language perspective. First is ghosts. And in some ways, the concept of ghost will seem very familiar. These are the dead who, in some way or another, their transition from the world of the living to the world of the dead didn't go the way it was supposed to go. They died unsatisfied. There's someone they want to take revenge on. They didn't get a proper burial. They had a death that was considered particularly cruel or unnatural. And they are haunting the living, trying to satisfy these needs that weren't satisfied.
So not so different from a Western ghost so far.
Not so different from a Western ghost so far. Then there are various kinds of divinities in these tales. And for people who are familiar, say, with Greek mythology, there isn't one simple Chinese pantheon that I can list 12 gods for you and you've got everyone important. It's a lot more complicated than that. So because there are gods drawing from different religious traditions. Right? There are Buddhist divinities, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. There are gods coming out of the Taoist tradition. There are gods coming out of what's kind of sloppily called Chinese popular religion. Some gods are acknowledged by the state as, okay, these are official gods that we should be making state sacrifices to. We give them honorific titles. Some gods are really coming up grassroots, worshipped by the people in a particular locality. And sometimes the government is really working very hard to get the worship of those local unofficial gods under control.
Okay, that's a little different.
Yes. So we have a very wide range of gods, ranging from very small local gods of the soil in a particular place. People may have heard of the kitchen god or the stove god, the idea of, you know, an individual household god in your own house, going up to gods of cities. But then, you know, there are also gods. There are gods associated with war, with a government exam.
That was one when I saw that. I thought a god of a government exam. So that would be like the civil service god.
Yes, yes, yes. The exam and education god, yes.
Wow. That one might become popular here.
It'd be a good university god.
Yes, yes.
A very good university god. There are another subclass of divinity that the Chinese word for them is xian. These were originally often mortal humans who, through various arts of self-cultivation, have become immortal. And some of them are worshipped, some of them are not. So we have a complicated picture about divinities.
Yes.
Then another category that doesn't translate as well are the shapeshifters. So we're familiar in Western culture with ideas of werewolves, that there's certain conditions under which humans might become monstrous and turn into animals.
Absolutely.
In the East Asian tradition, it's the other way around. There are certain conditions under which animals, and sometimes plants, and sometimes some inanimate objects, can attain the power to assume human shape. And these are commonly occurring figures of trouble or mischief, but sometimes sympathetic in these tales of the strange. And our Monkey King is probably the most famous creature in this category.
That one I can see where it would be maybe the first candidate for that kind of transition.
Well, actually, foxes are even more common, but that's another story.
Is that because they're sly and clever as in the West?
Perhaps that association, but there's a very long association between foxes and transformation. So perhaps because they're sly and clever, as in the West, perhaps because of this ecological niche they have of not being predators who threaten us humans directly, but they still compete with us for our poultry, possibly.
True.
Possibly because actual biological foxes like to burrow in pre-existing structures, including old tombs. So there could have been some associations between foxes and the grave. Possibly because they have been for a very long time in China as well as in Europe and now in the U.S., they're a wild animal that's very comfortable living at the edges of human habitation. They're right at that borderline. You don't have to go deep into the deep woods to encounter a fox the way you might a wolf or a tiger. So you can see them just in the bushes.
So they kind of, as you say, inherit this borderland, which could also be between human and animal.
Yes.
What about humans, or let's say superhumans? Do they figure in these stories?
Well, not perhaps in the Marvel superhero sense, but yes, there are humans who attain unusual powers by various means, usually by means of study or self-cultivation, various magical arts of illusion, of being able to travel over great distances, being able to conjure up objects when they weren't there formally. Some of these unusual figures are linked to the various religious traditions, right? So there are wandering Taoists who have special powers, or Buddhist monks who have special powers. Some of them don't have as clear an affiliation.
It would seem inevitable that there would be dragons in this literature?
Yes. Yes, dragons are a wonderful special case. By now I think a lot of the listeners are familiar with the fact that dragons in the East Asian tradition are rather different than in the Western tradition. The primary element with which the Chinese dragon, and more broadly the East Asian dragon, is associated is with water, not with fire. And it's with water in all of its stages of transformation. So dragons are the great bringers of rain. Dragons live under the water in major and also quite small bodies of water, in rivers, in lakes, in ponds. Dragons can be glimpsed in the sky around among the clouds, particularly when they're bringing rain.
So they're actually, and I can't think of a case in this other than very, very recently in a Disney movie or two, they're actually positive dragons if they bring rain.
Yes, well, they are potentially quite positive. They're not harmless. They could potentially be quite dangerous as well. But yes, and they were often worshipped in this capacity that they had as rainbringers.
Well, having looked at our cast of characters, let's tap into some of these stories and meet some of them up close and personal, as they say, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Rania Huntington, and she's telling us about Chinese literature of the supernatural, particularly prior to, say, the 19th century, and going back a long way in some cases. And we've met some of the major players in these stories, ghosts and shapeshifters, divinities of various traditions, some humans with extraordinary powers having to do with knowledge, that kind of thing, and then finally, inevitably, dragons. And, well, let's start with a good ghost story, Rania.
All right. So this is from an early 17th century collection by a man named Wang Tonggui. The Chinese title is Er Tan Lei Zeng, and that's something like Tales for the Ear Expanded by Categories.
It's a great title.
And this, you'll notice a bit of a sub-theme in these first couple of stories I talk about, and it's one that's been on all of our minds a lot recently, which is the topic of epidemic disease, because I was working on a small project related to the narration of epidemic disease in these tales. So this is a story with the title, The Old Man Buying Coffins. In the spring of 1482, an epidemic was rampant in central Wu. There happened to be an old man who entered the market at daybreak, and he said to the carpenter that, "My home is in Wu Zhongjing, and I want to buy 7 coffins." The carpenter asked for payment, and the man said, "Just transport the coffins and come with me, and then I'll pay you." The carpenter did as he asked and went hauling the coffins. And the old man entered the household first, saying, I only have 20 bushels of grain. I'll trouble you to discuss the payment with my relative who lives in the room in back. And the carpenter entered the empty room, and he saw 7 corpses lying on the ground. And the old man was among them. The relative from the room in back immediately arrived and paid the carpenter the 20 bushels of grain, which was all that the family had.
You know, that last line is almost an anticlimax, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like, well, yeah, we have to get to the business. There may be a ghost in the house, mm-hmm. but we still have to pay you your 20 bushels of grain.
Right.
But in a way, I mean, that could be something written by Daniel Defoe or somebody, you know. I mean, it was not too different from a classic Western ghost story, is it?
Right. Well, I think that, perhaps not too different, right? You have the twist, which is that the man who came to buy coffins was himself dead.
Right.
Right. That the ghost burying himself. I think, you know, one thing that when I talk to students about stories like this, that I always like to ask them, these are tales of the strange. When do they start being strange? What do they take for granted as normal? And it was not apparently at all shocking in the days of an epidemic that someone would show up to buy 7 coffins at the same time.
Sad but true.
Yeah. That's not shocking. What's shocking is that the ghost is left to take care of this business for himself. In some ways, it's also almost a hopeful story, right? Like the ghost
settling business.
Yeah, he settles his business and the carpenter gets paid, right? And gets paid. One thing that's really interesting, this is a story that I have 3 different versions of. One of them is almost identical to this one. Another one sets it 120 years later. It's the same basic plot, but instead of 20 bushels of grain for payment, it's silver. And that was reflecting the economic history of this period in China when the market was being flooded with silver, which was originally from the New World. So that the monetization of the Chinese economy that happened between 1482, this version of the old man buying coffins, and my version of it that's from the early 17th century, the monetization of the economy had gone through even to the netherworld. You know, even the ghosts knew that what you had to do to pay for goods.
A very current story, both above and below the ground. Now, I don't want to have a spoiler. I don't want to have a spoiler alert here. So before we go into our next story, I'll just say we won't say what category this is. But if you want to get us into it, we'll see what the twist in this story is.
Yes, and this is another one with a very ordinary sounding title, The Woman from E Village. And this is from an older collection than most of what I work on, but it's such a wonderful story. This is by a man named Hong Mai from a collection called Yi Jianzhi, which has been translated by someone as Records of the Listener. And this section of that very large collection of stories is from 1195, so we're 12th century here. In the 5th month of the first year of the Qingyuan reign, which was equivalent from about June 10th to July 8th in 1195, outside the southern gate of Huzhou, a woman with a pure white complexion wearing black arched shoes, and these arched meaning her feet were bound, walking all alone, called out to hire a small skiff, wanting to follow the He Mountain Road to go to Yi Village. After she got on the boat, before long, she lay down on her back, taking a reed mat to cover herself. The boat was really quite small, so if she tossed, turned, or coughed, it would certainly have been audible, but it was silent without any sound. The boatman was amazed by this, so he lifted up the mat to look, and he saw small black snakes a bit more than a couple of inches long, thousands of them in all, coiling and becoming a mass. Breaking out in a sweat with shock and terror, he covered them again with the mat. After they had gone 60 li, just as in li, measure of distance, eighth of a mile, just as they neared the shore, he hit the side of the boat to wake her. She stood up energetically, and she was in entirely human form, no different than when she had first gotten on his boat. She took 200 coins from her waist to pay the fee. The boatman dared not accept it. When she asked why, he said, "I happen to see you like that. How could I dare take the money?" She laughed. "Just don't tell anyone. I came here from the city to bring snake disease, but I'll go back in a month." She walked slowly into the bamboo forest, after several steps vanishing from view. In that village, there lived 700 to 800 families, and that summer, probably half of them died. In the beginning, Huzhou, Changzhou, and Xiuzhou had suffered from epidemic disease from the spring to the summer, especially Huzhou. Only the fifth month was a bit more calm, but in the sixth month, it broke out again. It must be that the snake woman returned again. How terrifying. The daughter of Shen Qingcheng married the Fujian general, Jan Yuanshan, and an old woman who came to Fuzhou, the implication being along in marriage as a servant, told this story.
Now that is definitely something with a bit more of an Eastern cast, I think. I can't, of course, there's shape-shifting in Western literature. The idea of, I've come here to bring plague is a little different.
Yes. And this is a story type of seeing, meeting the people, be they monsters, be they servants of the gods, who are preparing to bring plague to a particular region. And we're going to see in another tale of that type as well. And sometimes in those tales, there's a possibility of interference, and sometimes there's just horrified witness. And this is clearly a story of horrified witness. You know, the boatman was the unwitting man who transported the plague from the city out to the villages.
Yeah, so arguably it's a kind of a metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, arguably, yes, a kind of a metaphor. And one little thing, that are details that may not be all that interesting hearing these stories in passing, but I just wanted to mention because I think there's some of the really interesting things about this kind of story, is that all of these place names that I keep saying, these are real places. These are places that you can find on maps, right? So for the first audience of these stories, you know, they would be nodding their heads and going, "Oh, yeah, I have relatives in that town. It was bad that summer."
Yeah, or maybe looking over their shoulders.
Right, exactly. and that last bit of detail about who originally told the story is also something that is often included. And it's interesting to me in this case that it was a woman telling this story. It's a man who wrote it down, and most of the presumed audience would have been men. But the vision of this frightening female figure as the bringer of snake disease is being told by a female teller.
You have you've got a story here about a cartload of cowheads.
Yes.
Which is a little different.
All right. I'll go to that one. This is from about the same period as the first collection I was reading from. This is a collection from a man named Qian Xian. It's the Kuai Yuan Zhi Yi, Records of the Strange from the Garden of Cunning, published in 1613. And the title of this story is Guan Han Shou, number one. This is the god Guan Gong, Lord Guan, Guan Yu, who is a deification of a major general in early Chinese history. And he was a very popular god, and you can somewhat see that by the fact that the stories in this collection about this god are just, you know, story about Lord Guan number one, story about Lord Guan number two, and so forth.
Well, much the way we have sequential, you know, thrillers today.
Exactly. So a series of different stories at different times and places, but all about a very popular god. All right. So in the beginning of the Wanli reign, a certain vice director of the Bureau of Operations was in charge of affairs at Shanhaiguan. And this is up by the Great Wall. So this is like the pass between China and the borderlands to the north. One night, he dreamed of Lord Guan descending to his courtyard, summoning him to say, "Tomorrow at noon, a person of a strange manner will approach the pass, carrying 7 cartloads of cow heads. You must adamantly block him. He can't be let in." The dreamer respectfully assented and then startled and awoke. At dawn, he immediately commanded the soldiers and honor guard to guard the pass, warning them not to let anyone recklessly let merchants' carts enter. After the order had been sent down, the day gradually neared noon. Indeed, they saw people pushing 7 carts straight up to the pass. When they inspected them, they all contained cow heads, matching with the words of the god in the dream. Then the guard grew tighter and adamantly would not let them in. Only when it was nearing twilight did the merchants shove the carts back, saying, "If this place won't take them, we'll carry all of them to the west for people there to eat." Once the dust rose up, the guards could no longer see where they were. That year it was reported that the regions to the west suffered from cowhead plague, with 7 out of 10 people dying. But in Jizhou, Beijing, and its environs, the people were without ailments. Then they knew this was Lord Guan's silent assistance. Legend has it that at the gate at Shanhaiguan there was a shrine to Lord Guan. His heroic spirit has long been manifest there. That the Northeast relies on him to act as shield and city wall is not a falsehood.
Certainly a positive figure than a protector.
Exactly. So this is a story, again, of disease being transported across boundaries from one area to another. But this is the positive vision of someone being able to stop it. But what's interesting here is that the divine intervention doesn't take the form of the god himself showing up at the pass and blocking the carts. He instructs someone in a dream, right? So it's the god provides the information, but the action to block the disease comes from man.
Kind of consistent with a dream message.
Yes.
Tell us a dragon story.
All right. So this is not a terribly typical dragon story. I'll tell the story of the dragon mother. So in Gutian County in Fuzhou, there is a dragon mother temple, which has the most efficacious response to prayers. The legend says that a dragon turned into a handsome young man and had an affair with the daughter of a certain resident's family. She got pregnant, and the following year, on a certain month and date, in the middle of the night, with thunder and lightning, she had a son. But when it got light, she could not find where he was. When it reached the first watch of the night, he came again to nurse. It went on like this for more than a year. The mother said to her son, "My son, will you never let your mother see your face?" The son replied, "I fear seeing it will be of no benefit for you." She said, "I would rather see my son and die. My wish would be satisfied." Then they agreed he would come home on a certain day at noon, and his mother dressed up to await him. At the appointed time, wind and rain darkened the sky, sand flew and branches were broken. A white dragon lowered his head and peered under the eaves. His mother opened the door and saw him and immediately died of fear. Then he buried his mother lavishly. Half a li from the village, there were cliffs, and the dragon made a burrow in it, but that became a cave. The residents then built a shrine and made an image and placed it there. When there was a drought, they would pray there, and it always stirred response. And I'm going to stop there. But this is both a dragon story and a shapeshifter story. And it's also
not just right for Mother's Day, though.
Yes, not just right for Mother's Day, but it's also with that echo of I want to see your face. No, I can't let you see my face. There's an echo of an international folklore theme of Cupid and Psyche. Of course, in that case, it was lovers and not wanting to see the sun. The end of the story talks about there was a drought year later where the prayers at the shrine of the dragon mother weren't answered. So the locals, frustrated at the drought, took out the statue in the temple and whipped the statue. And suddenly there was a huge storm. And the people who had beaten the image of the dragon mother were thrown into the air and dropped and thrown into the air and dropped until they died. And then the locals prayed and said, of course, we've made a mistake. We're going to make a new shrine to your mother. And then they built the new shrine. And only when they built the new shrine did this unusual weather stop. So the dragon's son, although he killed his mother by revealing himself, is a very loyal son. He reacts quite violently to disrespect done to his mother's image, which is what makes her, by proxy, such a powerful goddess to provide rain.
And she insisted on seeing him in the first place, though, so he was obeying her there, too.
Exactly.
Despite those consequences. We'll look at some of the underlying themes in many of these stories when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Rania Huntington, and we're looking into Chinese literature of the supernatural and vast and varied phenomenon it is, too. Do we ever find stories in which we find something that we would expect here on Earth, part of our daily life, to carry over into the afterlife?
Very, very much so. We already saw a little bit of that when the ghost had to pay off his debts to buy all of the coffins. But the afterlife is very much envisioned as a bureaucracy with record keeping. And sometimes with errors in the paperwork that the powers that be have to figure out various ways to compensate for.
Some things don't change that much, in other words.
Right. So a story with an example of that is, again, from Wang Tonggui in Tales for the Ear, expanded by categories, The Girls from Tongcheng. In Tongcheng County of Anqing, a family at the East Gate and the West Gate each had a daughter who died of smallpox, each of them a bit over 10 years old. When the girl from the East Gate presented herself to the infernal official, he checked the roster and said, "Your good fortune is just beginning. You shouldn't die yet." He sent her back, but her corpse had already been cremated, so she returned and told the netherworld official this, asking, "What can I do?" The infernal soldier said to him that the corpse of the girl from the West Gate had not yet been destroyed. The infernal official checked the roster about the girl from the West Gate and said, "This is one who is supposed to die." Then he had her borrow this body for her soul to return. The girl at the West Gate had been dead for a while and then returned to life, so her family was overjoyed beyond their hopes. But the girl was stuck in embarrassment, not knowing who they were. She only remembered her parents at the East Gate and wanted to go to follow them. When the family at the East Gate heard of this, they welcomed her home. Her feelings and manners were precisely as before, but it was not their daughter's face. The family at the West Gate also didn't want to give up their daughter. They brought a lawsuit to court. At that time, the remonstrator Zhou from Jingling was magistrate of the county. His judgment says she has the body of the girl from the West Gate and the soul of the girl of the East Gate. The two families should take her in and together treat her as a daughter. This will bring peace by both sentiment and principle. From then on, the two families treated her as their daughter. When the time came for her to marry, they competed to complete her trousseau, and their son-in-law regarded them equally in his heart. Min Sishui from Jingling told this story.
That is different. At least I have not run across one of these body-soul bureaucracy issue stories before.
Yes, and this type of story that someone is hauled to the netherworld and it turns out it was a mistake somehow is moderately common. Wait a minute, there's somebody else with a name really, really close to mine.
Could happen in China.
Yeah, exactly. Or we have the same name, but you wanted the one from this town, not the one from that town. And sometimes we have people cooking the books, right? The Monkey King, there is a famous story of he was very frustrated when he was hauled to the netherworld because he thought he had already achieved immortality. But indeed, there was a record in the Book of Life and Death saying that he was supposed to die at a certain point. And he gets so angry that he not only crosses his own name out of the book, but he crosses the names of all the other monkeys out of the book. And so for this reason, old mountain monkeys never die because the Monkey King intervened and took them off the books.
So how would an audience, as you have indicated, a lot of these stories were told to orally, how would an audience have reacted to that story? Is it a comedy? Is it a satire?
For the Monkey King, I would say yes. I think it's a satire. I think there is some delight at somebody, at the trickster being able to overturn the powers that be. I think in the story of the girls from Tongcheng, I think there's an acknowledgement that the bureaucracy of hell is flawed, just the way that human bureaucracy can be flawed. And one of the things that's interesting here is that we have this dilemma that was created by the officials in the netherworld trying to cover for themselves, right? It's like, oops, we messed up. The wrong one died. Oh, we've got a body here. Okay, let's just make it work. But then you end up with someone, a girl, who two families can claim reasonably. And it's a human judge who has to come and say, look, you both have to treat her as a daughter. But one thing that, another note about the intersection of human structures and otherworldly structures here is that an unmarried daughter is one of the few people in the family structure you could do this with. If she had already been someone's wife, it would have been completely unacceptable to say, okay, both of you men should treat her as a husband.
Sure.
As a wife. Both of you men should act as her husband. That would have been unacceptable. A son would also have been more complicated because a son has this great duty to be making offerings to his ancestors. And he shouldn't be making offerings to two different fathers and two different grandfathers. But an unmarried girl in the traditions of the patriarchal society doesn't really belong to either family. She belongs to her husband's family. And so they're able to make this negotiation because their duty is to give her her dowry so that she can make a good marriage, and they both help in that.
Some of the underlying themes in ghost stories, those that I think even look for some kind of a theme or moral, would have to do with some form of enlightenment. Do we see that in these stories?
In the particular examples I've given you, not as much. But that the themes of enlightenment and seeing through illusion do run through this literature. Stories about dreams that make someone realize that actually the parts, the things in their own mortal life that they'd considered desperately important on a certain level are also like dreams. Stories about Buddhist and Taoist figures achieving their religious vocation and leaving their family for a higher plane of reality. So yes, enlightenment can be a recurring theme in these tales.
You've mentioned, of course, shape-shifting and crossing over from the real, I guess you could say, to the otherworldly. But this being the East, does reincarnation play a part in these stories?
Reincarnation is an important theme in these stories. I didn't prepare some of the examples, but I could tell a really short, wonderful one if we have time for one. All right. It also has to do with a dream. All right. So there's a man who's taken, and there's two versions of this. One of them's in Wang Tongwei's collection in the Tales for the Ear. One of them's in the Garden of Cunning collection, told about different men, different geographical details, but the basic plot's the same. So there's a man who's serving as an official in Huangzhou, and it happens to be his birthday. And he gets tired and he takes a nap. And he dreams. And in his dream, he walks out of his official residence and crosses the bridge and goes to a particular alley and turns into the alley and enters a particular house. And in that house, there's an old woman who feeds him a meal, including a particular kind of rice dumpling. And it's a very vivid dream. And he wakes up from the dream and he still has the taste of rice dumpling on his lips. And so he instructs one of his servants to follow his dream footsteps, cross the bridge, go to that alley, go to that house, and report back to me what you find there. And the servant does so, and what he finds there is a woman who is making offerings to her deceased husband. And on the altar is a plate of rice dumplings, which had been her husband's favorite food. And when they check, the death date of the husband and the birth date of the man who dreamed are the same day.
Yes, that's instant reincarnation.
Instant reincarnation, and also in dreams, he's going back to receive the offerings made to his former self, to his earlier identity, and that taste of a favorite food from your last life still lingers with him after he wakes up. After he wakes up from the dream,
so fast turnaround.
Yes,
I would imagine a lot of stories, ghost stories, stories of the strange, would have really to do, maybe even most of them would have to do with some kind of moral retribution.
Yeah, that is a major theme, right? That one way or another, evil deeds should be punished and good deeds can be rewarded. And sometimes this is done by a nameless powers that be. We're talking about reincarnation. There are stories often quite grisly stories about people who made their livings as butchers being reborn as pigs.
Oh, okay.
Right, to suffer exactly the same pain that they used to inflict on other beings. So there's stories like that where there's a cosmic order which is weighing out that you should suffer the suffering that you had inflicted. There are other stories in which it's the individual beings who are deciding to make the repayment, that the ghost is taking revenge, or if you help a non-human being, that they figure out an unexpected way to repay you. And sometimes that repayment can even also get involved in reincarnation. There are stories in which someone who feels that they owe a great debt to another person is reborn into that person's family as a son or a daughter to serve them as a filial child in the next life. Sometimes that payment on a debt isn't in a human form, that someone might come back to help the person that they owed a debt to as a dog or as a mule.
Well, that would suggest that you should really be nice to everybody in this life, because you never know what's going to happen the next time around.
Yes.
Well, Rania Huntington, it has been a pleasure delving into some of this wonderful and sometimes strange Chinese stories of the supernatural. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for the conversation.
And I hope you can join me next time for University of the Air.